This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Christopher Scott and I'm here with Professor Dr. Monica Chrisman. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I hope the same is true for you.
Yeah, no, I'm good. You're in Geisenheim at the moment. I'm in London. You're busy doing a harvest. Yes. In Rheingau. But what I want to talk to you this week about is the different methods of removing alcohol from the wine. Last week we talked about the EU rules, you know, wine's got to have 8.5% alcohol for it to be called wine, and then you just remove the alcohol perhaps. And we talked about trying to do things in the vineyard, which didn't seem very successful. It seems like, I must say, being a winemaker yourself, you've obviously got a slight approach that's winemaking led, but last week you were saying you've got to do it in the winery. So I think that we'll start off with what I think is probably the most famous method of de-alcoholizing, or at least I think it's probably the best myself, is spinning cone.
Yeah.
Would you say that is the leading technology at the moment for de-alcoholization?
For sure it belongs to the leading ones because it's a two-step procedure where in the first step you have some sort of pre-run where all the aroma is in, that's bound in some alcohol. So you only have to go into the unit with a small quantity. So it's not that all the wine needs to be treated. And then you go into the first column where at very low temperatures, which is normally below 25 degrees Celsius, you take out the alcohol to put, the aroma, which is bound in alcohol to really, let's say, preserve the aroma. And this already goes then into the blending tank. And then the de-aromatized wine goes into the second column. And there you remove the alcohol. And then the de-aromatized, de-alkalized product also goes into the blending tank.
Why is it called spinning cone? Because that sounds a bit like distillation.
It is some sort of distillation or rectification. You have some churning cones inside and you have a vapor coming up from the bottom and you have the wine coming down from the top. And because of the vapor, in the first step, the aroma is taken out, and in the second step, the alcohol is taken out. And because of this sort of centrifugation there, you have a very thin film and that makes this unit very effective. This is actually used also in other industries. So, for example, when you're dealing with spices sometimes, or even with some citrus oil or citrus things, this is not really invented for wine only, but it's very practical for us.
Yeah, I interviewed Miguel Torres, the winery from Spain, probably 10 years ago, and they were just starting to release their Miguel Torres alcohol-free wine using spinning cone. Mm-hmm. And they sort of described it then as being very, very good. From what I understand, the nice thing about spinning cone is it's got good throughput, hasn't it? You can produce a lot of it. So if you want to produce a reasonably large quantity of de-alkalized wine, spinning cone is a good technique. Is that your understanding?
Well, as I said, you only treat a certain portion, and it's also the question of how much alcohol you want to take out. With what product do you want to end up? But spinning cone for sure is one of the units which you can have in very large sizes. There are some custom facilities out there where you can deliver your wine and they do it for you, and they have these units in very big different sizes there. So when you have a small quantity, you use the smaller one. But for the bigger quantities, there are the big boys there as well.
Nice. Okay, so spinning cone, quite a popular technique. Is there any other techniques for removing alcohol?
Well, there are other possibilities, just a normal vacuum distillation, mm-hmm. which can be used, for example, for even making brandy. That's an option which works pretty much at the same temperature. There's a very famous company here nearby in Rüdesheim producing de-alkalized wines, I think, since 1903. I think they're the oldest in the world. And they're using a very good vacuum distillation there. The problem is that in Germany, for example, when you are using these techniques, it's considered to be a distillery. So you need to have, well, first of all, you have to pay tax for the alcohol, and also you need to have the right to do this distillation. And that's not so easy. That's different in other countries, but for us, it's a little bit complicated here. To give you an idea, we had the order from the German Ministry for Agriculture to run some trials But the German Ministry for Finance said, First we talk about the taxes there.
Fair enough. The advantage vacuum distillation has got is that by lowering the pressure with inside the tank,
yes, it going means, to a vacuum.
Yeah, then effectively the aromas or the alcohol, whatever you're trying to separate, comes out at a much lower temperature, and it avoids some of the problems of cooking the wine. Is that your understanding?
No, because at this temperature, you're not really cooking the wine. There is no thermal influence. That's not an issue there.
No, that's what I'm saying. By having a vacuum, you don't need the temperature, which saves the cooking.
Yes, that's correct. And also here, we did quite a lot of trials with the regular, the normal vacuum distillation, and also with spinning cone column. And also we used some membrane processes, which are normally conducted in combination with the distillation, because the membrane can only take out a water alcohol solution, which then needs to be distilled as well at low temperatures. But you know, when you go to totally alcohol-free wines, you might feel a difference there. But this is, I would say, it's a preference. So when you have five different tastes, you come up with six different opinions there. But when you reduce the alcohol by only, let's say, 2%, then there was no difference in any of the techniques. So it was even in comparison with the control wine, where we had no alcohol reduction, it was, from a statistical point of view, not possible to find a difference.
Oh, okay. So you can take a couple of percentage out and no one's any of the wiser.
Yeah. So and this is what I'm trying to say. We have, need to find possibilities, techniques, which allow us to really keep the aroma in there. But the problem is that even when all the aroma is still left in the product because of the missing alcohol, it's when you are below 4%, then you don't taste it as wine anymore. So there is a difference. Mm. And so you need to get the alcohol to assure there's some volatility of the aroma in there so that you get it in the nose. And there's alcohol quite helpful.
Oh, so alcohol's a bit like volatile acidity. It lifts the aroma, does it?
Well, not like volatile acidity, but it helps to really dilute the, or actually to have the aromas bound in there. And then normally when you swallow the wine, there is something what is called, sounds very scientific now, retronasal smell experience. It means in your mouth, there will some of the vapor going up in the back part to your nose, so that you can really smell and taste the wine in the nose.
Yeah. And you need the alcohol for that, do you? Or
yes, in order to make it recognized as a wine, you do need to have a little bit of alcohol in there. As I said, somewhere around 4%. We have very, very good product below 4%, but they will always be a little bit different to wine. And when the consumer is happy with that, when they think, yes, but it's a product where I don't have too much sugar in there, I have no alcohol in there, and it reminds me of wine, that's perfect.
Yeah. We're not quite there yet, though, are we?
We are working on that.
What are the advantages the beer industry's got compared to wine is that brewers can just add anything they want virtually, maybe not in Munich, but in most parts of the world, America, etc., they can just add stuff to fill in the hole that you get when you remove alcohol. Alcohol gives body to a wine, it gives width, and you remove it and it just creates this big hole. You know, some brewers in America are adding lactose to it. They're adding all sorts of things to their beers, which is perfectly legal. But for wine, we're not allowed to add any products.
Yes, that's correct. So everything what is legal to be added to the wine is also legal for the alcoholized wine. But you have to do it before the alcoholization, because after that, it's considered to be foodstuff. And then that will change also for wine in the future. You need to have an ingredient listing on the label. So when you add something, it will need to go on the label. And for wine, that's not very much what you are allowed to do. There could be some, a little bit of residual sugar in there, which fills the hole, which fills the gap. Or very often you find sparkling products, which are also sort of, you know, helping with the CO2 in there. And sometimes you can use so-called monoproteins. That's a protein coming from the yeast, actually, which creates some mouthfeel, some body in the mouth. And this is legal to avoid tartrate in stabilization.
Tell me about this monoprotein. I've never heard of it. So it's a byproduct of fermentation, is it? Or is it like lees?
Well, no, it's coming actually out of the yeast.
So is it like lees? Is it the thing that you do when you do lees work?
So for example, you probably know when you keep a wine on the lees after fermentation, as they very often do in barrels, in barriques, and then they do a lees stirring, and the wine gets more complex, it gets more body. And this is because the yeast releases some of the so-called monoproteins, which create some body. And of course, these monoproteins can also be purchased in the market there, but it's originally coming from the yeast. It's totally natural.
And you can add monoproteins to the wine before fermentation. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, normally this is done, or it's allowed, it's legalized to avoid or control tartrate instabilization, because it serves like a coating around the tartrate and the acidity, and the acid, so that it's the partners are not meeting.
Do non- and low alcohol wine producers do this? They add monoproteins to the wine before fermentation?
Well, that's a possibility. That has been legalized by the OIV in Paris, by the International Office for Wine and Wine. That's a possibility, what one can do. But, normally these products also have a little bit of a certain taste. And when you add too much, it appears to be very artificial. So I don't think that consumers would actually, or the producers would actually do that, and the consumers wouldn't like it. So it's more likely that they would play a little bit with higher levels of sugar in the product.
Yeah, because sugar gives a lot of body to wine. So even a small amount of sugar can fill quite a big hole in terms of the mouthfeel.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there any other, like lees stirring is a classic way of adding some textural feel to your mouth and perfectly legitimate way of doing it. Yeah. Often lees stirring is done on the final wine. If you're going to do some lees stirring, would you de-alkalize the wine first and then do the lees stirring or the lees work, or would you do it?
No, you would have to do that up before that. Because the moment when you have alcohol reduced, the product is very unstable. So there is, it's paradise for all kind of microorganisms in there, which are most the spoilage ones, not the good ones. So when you have the alcohol reduction, you normally better transport it directly to the winery, and then you do the bottling like immediately.
Okay, and it's got to be sterile bottling as well, pretty clean.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, and that makes sense, actually. Yeah, that makes sense. We do rebottling of certain wines for courses like WSET, and we have found that occasionally we do it for other events as well, and we get people who are non-drinkers, so we ship them de-alkalized wines, but they're fine for the course because it's normally a couple of weeks, but they have no ability to last. You know, you give them a couple.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same when you open some milk or orange juice and keep it in the fridge. After 2 days, you better drink it.
Yeah. Is it just microbiological spoilage is the main concern? Because normally things like acidity and tannins, acidity controls the speed of your tannins polymerizing and all sorts of stuff. But this is just spoilage.
Yes, that's the main issue there. And this is why I said it's very important that you choose the wine after it's been fermented, after you did all the necessary treatments, and then do the alcohol reduction, because afterwards there's not much chance to do something about it.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I understand that. And the last method that you touched on, but we didn't really talk about, was membrane or reverse osmosis in terms of removing alcohol from the wine. Do you want to just give us a sort of very brief description of that and whether it's any good?
You have a membrane. Again, you only use a certain portion of the wine if you want to make an alcohol reduced and not alcohol free wine. And then you go over a membrane which has pores in there of the size of alcohol and water. And this goes through, the rest remains in that circle there. And then with the water alcohol solution, you go through a vacuum distillation and you remove the alcohol. And that what is then the rest, which is sort of grape water, goes back to the product.
Yeah. Okay. But you're saying that it's used for lower alcohol wines as opposed to alcohol free. Why is that? Why can't they just use reverse osmosis to remove all the alcohol or most of it?
Well, for that you would need to run the entire product, and would have to go through the circle quite often in order to get all the alcohol out, and that takes a long time, and so it's a little bit of a damage to the quality of the product. Then I would only use a vacuum distillation or spinning cone, but I would not use a membrane in combination.
Okay, all right. Now that sounds excellent, Monica. I think that's answered all my questions. You've obviously got an interest in low alcohol wines and de-alcoholized wines. Is there any wines that you could recommend to our listeners that you think are good examples of the style?
Well, for the de-alcoholized wine, the product we just made here, I think that's very good. And then also there is this company in Rüdesheim called Jung, Carl Jung, and I think they're making some very excellent wines there.
And that's de-alcoholized, is it?
De-alcoholized.
Is there any alcohol-free wine you'd recommend?
Well, this is alcohol-free at this stage.
Okay.
We only have to change the wording. So as of sometime next year, we are not allowed to use alcohol-free anymore because there are some little residues of alcohol in there. And these people from the consumer's protection side, they don't want to have that. They say this is, this is not correct because there is still some alcohol in there. Mm. Very often it's less than you will find in an orange juice, but still.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. We've talked about what's going on in Europe quite a lot. In America, they've got their own set of rules. And usually, I don't know for sure, but usually the Americans are a little bit more relaxed than the Europeans when it comes to rules. Is there anything in America that you're aware of that is banned in the EU but is quite good?
No, I think they are doing pretty much the same as we do. And I know that there's some custom facilities in California and some other regions which will do the de-alcoholization or alcohol reduction for you. I was visiting once with my students there, and the guy, and that's some years ago, the guy who owns the company said, it's a very lonely business. Whenever I go to the party, nobody says hello, but they're all my clients. So I think that for in the past, nobody wanted really to talk about alcohol reduction, but that has totally changed now.
Yeah, it's very topical, isn't it? What about, just out of curiosity, I often hear of stories of, I've harvested my Zinfandel, the alcohol's coming in at 17%. The way we can get it down is just run a hose into the tank for a while. Have you heard? I mean, that's one way of reducing your alcohol.
Well, in some areas where we have a very high amount of temperature and also heat impact and sun impact, really the alcohol levels can go up. So some of the very traditional areas, particularly for Rieslings, they do have a problem for the future. So we are going up to higher elevations or more the side valleys to keep the style of wine we have been producing, because we have two options. Either we're going to do something and keep the style we have, or we have to train our consumers to accept new wine styles. Mm. So that's the difference. But having new wine styles, there's a much stronger competition worldwide on a global scale because the wines are so similar. Mm. And I also know that there are people who do not use any technical support, but they're adding some water. They're called Jesus units. So, water to wine. And that's legal in some countries.
Yes, well, it's legal in certain countries, but most people would never admit to it. Is it legal in the EU?
They claim that the osmotic pressure on the yeast is so high that you cannot really ensure a very good fermentation, and therefore by diluting the sugar concentration a little bit, then you have a much better possibility for good fermentation, and that's the reason for that.
Yeah, just for the listeners, osmotic pressure on the yeast. I presume you're talking about lots of sugar on one side of the yeast cell and very little in the other, which draws the water from inside the yeast cell, basically drying it out. It's a bit like preserving meat with salted beef. The salt draws the liquid out of the yeast cell or the bacteria killing it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right then, Monica. I think we'll wrap it up there.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You get back to those tanks and presses.
Okay, sure then. Bye.
Bye.